The following is a paid presentation. The views and opinions expressed do not necessarily reflect those of WIFE or Whitewater Broadcasting. It's time for To Your Health, brought to you by Rush Memorial Hospital. A weekly visit with the healthcare professionals at Rush Memorial to introduce you to the employees and the various programs at the hospital. And now, your host, Mary Frances Friedel.
Good morning. We're here today with Dr. Gregory Hyde, the ear, nose, and throat specialist from Rush Memorial Hospital. And Dr. Hyde is going to be discussing obstructive sleep apnea. Good morning, Dr. Hyde.
Good morning, Mary Frances. Thank you for this opportunity.
Oh, thank you so much for coming on. The more I talked to you in getting ready for this show, the more fascinating this topic became. Could you please explain to our audience exactly what is obstructive sleep apnea?
Obstructive sleep apnea means that you have a collapse or narrowing of the airway such that it becomes a disturber to your sleep. There are two different metrics or things that we try to document when we're working up somebody for this. One is an actual stoppage of the breath, which would be called an apnea. On average, people breathe about 12 times a minute when we're asleep, or once every 5 seconds. And so an apnea is described or defined as a pause of 10 seconds or longer in the breathing. So that means that you miss two or more breaths in succession. So that then gets scored on a sleep study as an apneic event. What further adds credence to that is if we see a drop in the oxygen level measured by oxygen saturation with a little probe that's worn on the finger during the sleep study. So that also shows that that was a major event that caused stress to the body. The other type of event is called a hypopnea, or you might think of it as a half breath. And it's defined as a 50% or greater reduction in airflow. So say somebody is snoring but is still moving some air, but they basically have a significant reduction in the amount of airflow of 50% or more, then that can be, in many cases, as detrimental as holding the breath. And we'll also see oxygen desaturations of 3 to 4% when those occur. When a sleep study is scored, then we add up all the apneas and hypopneas through the entire night and then divide that by the number of hours that were measured during the study. And that gives us an average per hour, also known as an index. And so the severity of the disease is actually reported as an apnea-hypopnea index. Anything that's 30 or more is considered severe, which when you think about it, that would mean that once every 2 minutes, you are having a significant pause or alteration in your breathing. And these can have huge detrimental effects on not only the quality of our sleep, but even our waking physiology.
What causes this?
Any form of obstruction, and that can be either permanent or variable between the tip of the nose and the vocal cords, can cause obstructive sleep apnea symptoms. So we're designed to just be nose breathers at night. It's not normal to breathe through your mouth. And that's true from the time we're born. Actually, at birth, we can't breathe through our mouth. Did you know that?
No, I had no idea.
So our airways are set up so that we have a separate respiratory and digestive system. That's why infants can suckle or nurse and breathe at the same time. As we develop, the voice box drops in the throat, so we have a common pathway now between the aero and digestive tracts. But we are designed primarily to be nose breathers at night because mouth breathing is an active process. And when we get into the deepest levels of sleep, our body needs to be able to fully relax. In fact, during REM sleep, our muscles become paralyzed with the exception of our eye muscles and our breathing muscles. And so if you're doing an active process, you can't maintain that and get into the deepest levels of sleep. So that disrupts your sleep architecture or the stages of sleep. So from the tip of the nose, you have things like nasal injuries, septal deviations, nasal polyps, enlargement of the turbinates, which are the ridges that are on the sidewall of the nose, allergies. All of those things can cause problems with nasal congestion at night. Dust mite allergies, which are in your bed with you, are a huge contributor. And I found many people with sleep apnea have super high sensitivities to dust mites. We improve that, their nasal airway improves, and so does their sleep. Going further along the line, there can be problems with the soft palate, the flap in the back of the throat. If it's too long, if it's too floppy, it can collapse and cause problems. Below that, we have the tongue. If people have a undiagnosed tongue tie condition, their tongue is anchored to the floor of their mouth, which means that instead of sitting up in the roof of the mouth, which pulls the tongue forward, it sits low and too far posteriorly, which narrows the gap between the back of the tongue and the back wall of the throat. When they lay on their back, especially, the tongue will then collapse against the back wall of the throat and block their airway. And this is probably by far the most common thing that I see. I've done over 1,000 sleep endoscopies where I've examined the airway using a fiber optic scope while people were under some conscious sedation from an anesthesia provider. And probably 9 out of 10, I see tongue base collapse, causing their sleep apnea. Below that, you've got a little flap that sits above the opening of the voice box called the epiglottis. It can actually become weakened or destabilized and can collapse into the airway as well. And then any kind of masses, cysts, big tonsils, large adenoids, all of those types of things can also contribute to airway obstruction.
How would a patient find out what the issue was? Someone who had been diagnosed with sleep apnea.
Sure. I very strongly believe and want to stress that anyone who has been diagnosed with sleep apnea and is being treated with CPAP, if they've never had a thorough airway exam by an ear, nose, and throat specialist, that needs to be done. There are basically three different specialties that support the treatment of this disease, with neurology and pulmonary medicine being usually more heavily involved in the diagnostic part of it as far as ordering the sleep studies. But the ear, nose, and throat specialists are really the ones with the training and the tools to be able to fully evaluate the airway and identify where's the blockage coming from, which many people want to know.
What are some of the symptoms of obstructive sleep apnea?
Well, because it disrupts your sleep patterns, you don't get the normal stages of sleep, which include REM sleep and something called delta wave or N2 sleep, which is the deep, deep physiologic sleep where our body actually repairs itself, and it's where our brain resets, our adrenals reset, and where messengers are sent to all the hormone-secreting glands of our body that control our metabolism and our aging process. Children have lots of N2 sleep. We've all picked up a sleeping child and carried them off into bed and bounced them into bed, and they don't stir, they don't wake up, right? That's because they're in this deep N2 sleep. When we're aroused from N2 sleep, you literally feel like you're drugged, and it takes sometimes 30 to 60 minutes for your head to clear because of that deep hypnotic effect of that stage of sleep. When you don't have those sleep stages, then lots of physiology starts to break down. We tend to go from what's known as a parasympathetic, or I am safe and running optimally, state of being, to a I am just trying to survive state of being, which is called the sympathetic or fight or flight mode. That has all kinds of increased stresses on the cardiovascular system. This is one of the chief causes of new onset hypertension. And if you've been diagnosed recently with high blood pressure, then really you should be considered for a sleep study to make sure that that isn't what's causing it. Uncontrolled hypertension is frequently undiagnosed sleep apnea that is if you're requiring multiple medications to control it. Problems with cardiac arrhythmias, things like that. Problems with nightmares. So in my mind, that's your subconscious trying to wake you up because you're not breathing enough. So you have these bad dreams, a lot of times dreams that involve you dying, being held underwater, falling off a cliff, being chased by the boogeyman, whatever. And we certainly see this in children a lot, where they'll have night terrors because they're having sleep apnea, usually due to big tonsils and adenoids. In kids and adults, it can also affect the urinary tract. In kids, that manifests as bedwetting. In adults, it means getting up to go pee 2, 3, 4 times a night. It's not a problem with the size of the bladder, it's a problem with the breathing. When we stop breathing, the sphincters on the bladder relax. The not breathing wakes us up, but we feel that now the urine is trying to get out, and so we get up and go pee. So lots of that goes away once we solve the breathing issues. And finally, if you have sleep apnea, you're not dreaming. Usually you're in REM sleep, which is when our body fully relaxes. That's when the sleep apnea usually gets the worst. And that will kick you out of REM sleep. And so you miss all those dream cycles and won't ever feel like you're having dreams.
Well, are some people more likely to get obstructive sleep apnea than others?
Yes, certainly this is a disease that is associated with weight. And as America's waistline continues to expand, the number of people who are clinically obese increases every year, unfortunately. That contributes more and more to sleep apnea. Unfortunately, the weight leads to sleep apnea, which then leads to more weight because our body's metabolism actually slows down as a result of this disease. It becomes more and more difficult for us to use oxygen because we're depriving the body from oxygen every night. So the body essentially kind of turns the thermostat down or turns the furnace down, which requires oxygen to burn, right? And so during the daytime, it can be very hard to burn calories because you didn't sleep well the night before due to the sleep apnea issues. So I've had people with the treatment of sleep apnea just wearing a CPAP, which we'll talk about in a minute, allowed them to lose. I remember one gentleman lost 65 pounds just by putting a CPAP on him. He didn't change the way he ate, the way he exercised, but we now allowed his oxygen levels to stay normal throughout the night, so he's able to burn calories more efficiently.
Well, if that's not a sales pitch for getting apnea diagnosed, I don't know what is, because really, if you can lose weight by sleeping better, I think you would feel better all the way around. And it certainly does beat trying to stay on a diet.
Yeah. There's some standardized questionnaires that have been scientifically proven, ones by Dr. Epworth, who's in Australia. It's called the Epworth Sleepiness Survey. You can find these online. And we do have those as screening tools in our clinic where people will be asked questions like, have you ever fallen asleep in a dark room after lunch? How often do you take naps? Have you ever fallen asleep at a stop sign? If you score a 10 or greater out of 21 possible points, then you're considered at high risk for sleep apnea.
Can you please explain how obstructive sleep apnea is diagnosed?
Yes, that usually requires doing a sleep study. Historically, those have been performed in a sleep lab with a attendant or technician doing usually up to two people simultaneously in adjacent rooms. These are sometimes located in hospitals, but can also be located in standalone sleep study facilities. That test person comes in and they have almost 30 wires put on their body because we're doing EEGs. We're measuring all the brain waves. We're looking at eye muscle movement, jaw tension, as well as cardiac EKG leads, and even muscle leads down on the legs to look for leg movement. So that is the most comprehensive way to diagnose sleep. It's called a polysomnogram. Because I deal primarily with obstructive sleep apnea, I'm less concerned about EEGs and stages of sleep and more about what they're doing with their airway. And we're able to do that with a home study now that has been approved by the FDA for this purpose. And so I can send an order into a company that will mail a small device to the individual's home, and they strap it to their forearm, and there's three different sensors that come off. One is a light that shines through the finger that measures the amount of oxygen in the blood and the heart rate. Another is a string that goes around the chest, which measures chest wall movement. And the final one is a temperature sensor that goes onto the upper lip that measures airflow through the nose or mouth. And with those pieces of information, we can tell if the patient is trying to breathe but not moving any air, or if there's a reduction in airflow, and then what is the heart and blood oxygen levels response to those events. And that's adequate to diagnose obstructive sleep apnea and get somebody qualified for treatment.
And this only takes one night of sleep?
Usually one night of sleep. Actually, if we can get at least 4 hours of documented sleep, that a lot of times is enough to qualify. I like the home studies because they're in their own bed, in their own environment. I was the medical director of three different sleep labs early in my career, and I always worried that the fact that we had them in a strange bed with 30 wires was going to affect their quality of sleep. How could
yes.
it not, right?
Exactly. Yes, I think that would.
Yeah, so the more deeper and natural the sleep, the more likely we're going to, you know, catch them in the act of what they're doing type of thing.
Right. So once it's diagnosed, how is obstructive sleep apnea treated?
The first line treatment, I think everybody still agrees, is to support the breathing, decrease the resistance, and in essence, blow the airway open by giving pressurized air to the person to breathe. And that's done through a device called the CPAP, C-P-A-P, which stands for Continuous Positive Air Pressure. And this is a machine that's designed to maintain a certain pressure by airflow. And that's usually applied with a mask that'll either fit over the nose or nose and mouth, or there's also another interface where there's little cushions or pillows that fit up against the tip of the nose. And we usually try to find an interface for the patient that's comfortable for them to wear and that the interface itself doesn't disrupt the sleep. And during the night, the machine will apply pressure to the airway, which will overcome the resistance and kind of act as a pneumatic splint, an air pressure splint, and keeping things from collapsing. So this can be very dramatic as far as improvement in the patient's sleep and breathing. I've had some patients actually describe it almost as a Lazarus type of thing. You know, I felt like I was dead on my feet all the time, and now I've got energy I didn't believe I could ever have again. And that's, you know, taking them from that non-oxygen anaerobic state back into a more aerobic state as far as their metabolism. They can make 38 ATP with a molecule of oxygen rather than just 2 ATP. Without oxygen. So that's a lot more currency in the metabolic bank, so to speak, to get up and do the things you need to do every day.
So they're getting a lot more energy and feeling a whole lot better.
A whole lot better. The brain and the heart are the two most sensitive organs to this type of disease because they're the most oxygen sensitive. And so I've seen lots of people with neurodegenerative disorders, which were probably triggered to a large extent by the fact that they had undiagnosed sleep apnea. They were basically losing brain cells every night because their oxygen levels were going too low. I've also seen that with heart disease, where I've had patients in their 40s qualify for a cardiac transplant that never had a heart attack, never had any coronary artery disease, but they'd had sleep apnea since childhood. And so every night they were losing heart muscle cells due to the low oxygen levels.
So it seems like the price of leaving this untreated can be pretty steep.
Huge, huge. The two diseases that we have the strongest correlations with are stroke, I believe. In one study, there was found to be a 12-fold increased risk of stroke in people with untreated sleep apnea. So that's enormous. And then, the cardiac risk, the risk of sudden cardiac death, dying in your sleep of a cardiac event, can be huge as well. I remember one gentleman early on in my career that would diagnose sleep apnea, and I'd sent off an order for CPAP, and there was a delay with the supplier, the respiratory company, getting a CPAP into his hands, and he actually ended up having a heart attack while he was waiting for a CPAP. When the cardiologist did the angiogram to see where the blockages were, there weren't any. He didn't have calcium plaques in his arteries. They'd gone into spasm due to low oxygen levels. And that taught me a great lesson early on in my career, to where I hound the suppliers to make sure they're paying attention and they've received the orders and we're getting after this.
Right.
Because people with this disease are literally a ticking time bomb. Nobody knows when it's going to go off, and the effects can be devastating. It can change somebody's life forever.
Are there surgical ways to treat obstructive sleep apnea?
Yes, there can be. And I will usually work hard with my sleep apnea patients to try to identify those once we've stabilized them with CPAP. That stops the ticking time bomb, so to speak, or diffuses it, to where then we can take stress off the body. Putting somebody under additional stress of surgery and anesthesia when they have sleep apnea can be a life-challenging event because they don't have a normal drive to breathe. And so the sleep that we give them with anesthesia may have been the best sleep that they've had in years. And getting them to wake up afterwards can then be problematic because the brain's like, hit the snooze button. We're not done sleeping yet, right? So I usually first focus on that. But then, you know, examining from the tip of the nose down to the level of the vocal cords, identifying obstructions that are having, doing a functional exam with the sleep endoscopy that I mentioned, where under some light conscious sedation, but basically putting somebody into sleep and getting them snoring and doing their sleep apnea thing, and then videotaping what their airway does by using a small flexible endoscope that's about the diameter of a strand of spaghetti going through the nose and looking at the entire airway all the way down into the beginning of the trachea. Then we can get a good idea of here's where the problems are, and then these are some options that can be done to help improve those areas of the airway without alleviate or lessen the necessity of being on a CPAP every night. And I've been able to help quite a few people with that in the course of my career.
Well, that sounds fantastic. I can imagine a lot of people would not necessarily want to be tied to a machine to breathe every night for the rest of their lives. So it's nice to know that sometimes this can be fixed in a permanent way. Thank you so much for coming on today, Dr. Hyde, and we look forward to having you again.
You can listen to past shows of To Your Health. Log on to rushmemorial.com and click on podcasts. Join us again next week for another visit with Rush Memorial Hospital. It's To Your Health, brought to you by Rush Memorial Hospital on Hometown Country 94.3 WIFE. The proceeding was a paid presentation. The views and opinions expressed do not necessarily reflect those of WIFE or Whitewater Broadcasting.